Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 228, a number of miscellaneous articles and updates on previous stories. In For the Record program number 225, we dealt with the issue of AIDS and South Africa. Specifically, elements within the South African government have unfortunately been giving credence to some advocates of a position that the HIV does not cause AIDS. Now, in the column I'm about to read, there are not only some very substantive and relevant criticisms of that particular position, but I want to note that Peter Duisberg, the most notable of the critics of the, by now, established fact, frankly, that HIV causes AIDS, although it does so in combination with other viruses and other things that help to activate the compromised immune system, at which point AIDS kicks in. Peter Duisberg himself is linked to the chain of events involved in the almost certain deliberate creation and dissemination of AIDS. And as I noted in For the Record program 225, both the events that appear to have culminated in the development of AIDS, including the importation of Eric Traub and Anna Burger, respectively, Hitler's chief of bacteriological and virological warfare, and his assistant, those two brought into the United States under the auspices of Project Paperclip, and also the genesis of the South African government, and specifically the Bruderbond, the secret elite society at the core of the apartheid regime, both have common roots in the Third Reich. Again, the development of AIDS appears to have stemmed in considerable measure or from a series of events involving the importation of Eric Traub and Anna Burger to work in the United States under Project Paperclip. They, in turn, were involved with a number of institutions, including elements of the U.S. Navy's Biological Warfare Research Program and the University of California. Peter Duisberg was involved with those same events. He also, in a conversation with Robert Gallo in 1971, disclosed that he knew that AIDS-like viruses produced AIDS-like symptoms. His subsequent denials to the contrary, published in the right-wing Regnery by the right-wing Regnery publisher, to the contrary, notwithstanding. His statements to the contrary, notwithstanding. Note again that the genesis of the apartheid regime of South Africa also had roots in the Third Reich. The Bruderbond was not only structured along the lines of, but politically allied with, the Nazi Party in Germany during World War II. The notion that AIDS is not caused by HIV and the potentially, certainly unfortunate and potentially tragic and deadly acceptance of that hypothesis by the South African government, the focal point of a column in the San Francisco Examiner on Wednesday, April 26th of the year 2000. This is a column by Bruce Merkin, identified here as a freelance writer in San Francisco, or Brumps Merkin. Actually, it's Bruce, B-R-U-C-E. There's a mispronunciation or misspelling at the bottom of the column. This is entitled Dangerous Denial of AIDS Holocaust in South Africa. And Mr. Merkin has made a very good point in that he characterizes the people who deny that HIV is behind AIDS as basically Holocaust deniers. And just as David Irving and company have sympathies with the Third Reich, I think, too, the crowd that maintains that HIV does not cause AIDS are literally engaged in denying a Holocaust and merit serious consideration as accessories to genocide. Note some of the substantive and some of the substantive criticisms of that position and some of the frankly politically racist implications of that political position. This particular column, again from the Examiner of 4/26/2000 by Bruce Merkin, Dangerous Denial of AIDS Holocaust in South Africa, reads in part as follows. Holocaust denial, the claim by fringe groups that Nazis in World War II didn't really murder millions of Jews and others, has long been discredited. Now, however, South African President Thabo Mbeki appears to be actively flirting with a new form of Holocaust denial, one that claims that HIV is harmless, AIDS is a phony epidemic, and the only thing endangering the health of Africans is the same set of poverty-related health issues the continent has long faced. Skipping down, the HIV is harmless crowd's usual line, that it is the use of recreational drugs, ACT, and other pharmaceuticals, not HIV, that really causes immune suppression and death, makes no sense in Africa. so they simply declare AIDS non-existent. I would note parenthetically that AZT itself does help to devastate the immune system, but it has very little distribution in Africa, and it is not behind the AIDS epidemic in Africa, since very little of it has been distributed. Most of the people there can't afford it, and there are other criticisms of the readily discountable hypothesis that has been added, that has been put together by these individuals, and those are delineated by Mr. Merkin in the text that follows. Continuing, resuming with the last sentence. The HIV is harmless crowd's usual line, that it is the use of recreational drugs, AZT, and other pharmaceuticals, not HIV, that really causes immune suppression and death, makes no sense in Africa. So they simply declare AIDS non-existent. In an article in the March 14th South Africa Globe and Mail, Charles Geschechter, professor of African history at Cal State Chico and a vocal AIDS denier, makes much of the lack of reliable health statistics in Africa. That's hardly a surprise in a poor continent lacking in health infrastructure and funding, but Geschechter uses it as an excuse to declare all of African AIDS a fraud. I would note that the National Institute of Health, one of the branches of which the National Cancer Institute and the World Health Organization are deeply involved in monitoring epidemics around the world and in Africa, so some of the statistics that they have disseminated are frankly suspect, because in fact one of the institutions involved in developing those statistics is implicated in the apparently deliberate creation and dissemination of AIDS. Continuing, speaking of Geschechter's article, the scandal, he writes, is that long-standing ailments that are largely the product of poverty are being blamed on a sexually transmitted virus, unquote. There is no epidemic, just a variety of, quote, old sicknesses, unquote, that have been, quote, dressed up as HIV/AIDS. Why have public health authorities perpetrated this fraud? Because, quote, dysentery and malaria do not yield headlines or fatten public health budgets. Plagues and infectious diseases do, unquote. Such a view denies both common sense and African reality, says Mark Schuf, who just won a much-deserved Pulitzer Prize for his Village Voice series on AIDS in Africa. Schuf conducted hundreds of interviews in 9 countries over a period of 6 months and knows as much about African AIDS as nearly any Westerner. First of all, he told me recently, many of the Africans dying of AIDS are middle-class people with jobs. Hardly the disease-ridden, emaciated caricature which the AIDS dissidents conjure up. I would note, too, that a racist element wanting to destroy developing societies in Africa would want to destroy the educated and middle-class and affluent people. That would be one of the groups that is apparently being devastated by AIDS. Continuing, quote, second, to account for the HIV-induced rise in adult mortality and disease, the dissidents would have to argue that the general status of poor people in, say, South Africa is actually worse under black rule than it was under apartheid. This is preposterous on its face, as the ANC has built hundreds of thousands of new homes, provided clean water and electricity to impoverished rural areas and townships, and launched a new primary health care system, unquote. If AIDS in Africa is simply a question of poverty and poor sanitation, the victims should be those whose health is always most vulnerable, the elderly. In fact, Schuf explained, the whole burden of disease has changed since the advent of HIV. Doctors in virtually every East and Southern African hospital I visited said they had witnessed huge increases in young adults coming in with multiple diseases and or not recovering from ordinary diseases such as TB, unquote. In other words, the group that would be most readily devastated by the types of ailments that people like Geschechter are trying to attribute the AIDS epidemic to are the elderly. They are not being attacked. In fact, younger people, young adults coming in with multiple diseases and diseases that they would normally recover from are the ones being affected by the AIDS epidemic. And note also the distinctly racist slant that those who deny that HIV in Africa is producing the AIDS epidemic. Note that the AIDS epidemic, which has afflicted South Africa since the apartheid regime was overthrown, would basically be predicated on it's certainly a sustaining, if not an increasing, of the deleterious living conditions under which blacks had to survive. In fact, the ANC has significantly improved the living conditions in South Africa, and there is a distinctly propagandistic and racist bent to the contention of people like Duisburg. That really should not come as that much of a surprise, given the heritage of not only Duisburg, but also noting the area of overlap between these critics and people like Duisburg, the development of AIDS, and the development of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Noting also that, as we looked at in 225, a doctor who had ostensibly developed a vaginal suppository that would cure AIDS had also apparently been involved in collaboration between the CIA and the apartheid regime in developing biological weapons for the apartheid regime. That individual died under strained circumstances. We looked at that at the end of For the Record program 225. Another fascinating story came to light this past week. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, April 29th of the year 2000. This also involves past covert operations, and one of the covert operations that was involved in the chain of events that precipitated the assassination of President Kennedy. It is also one of the many events involving the rise of Fidel Castro and the resulting anti-Castro Cuban effort in conjunction with elements of U.S. intelligence. The anti-Castro Cuban community has come into sharp focus in recent months in connection with what I call the alien invasion, the alien Gonzalez story, which has dominated the news to the dismay of many who've been trying to pay attention to much more, trying to weed out the much more important news from the alien invasion. Again, San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, April 29th of the year 2000, an article by Vernon Loeb, L-O-E-B, in the Washington Post, Dateline Washington, headlined, CIA knew Soviets had learned a Bay of Pigs date. This article reads in part as follows. Shortly after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961, a top CIA official told an investigative commission that the Soviet Union had somehow learned the exact date of the amphibious landing in advance, according to a newly declassified version of the commission's report. Moreover, the CIA apparently had known of the leak to the Soviets and went ahead with the invasion anyway. In an effort to oust Fidel Castro, the CIA organized and trained a force of about 1,400 Cuban exiles and launched the invasion on April 17, 1961. Castro's soldiers easily repelled the landing force in less than 72 hours, killing 200 rebels and capturing 1,197 others in what became one of the worst foreign policy blunders of the Cold War. The investigative commission chaired by General Maxwell Taylor was established almost immediately and held a series of secret meetings at the Pentagon before sending a sharply critical report to President Kennedy in June of 1961. While portions of the Taylor Commission's report were made public on two previous occasions in 1977 and 1986, many pages had been blacked out for security reasons by the CIA. The newly declassified version, in contrast, is nearly free of deletions and contains a wealth of new detail. The National Archives released the document late Wednesday to the nonprofit National Security Archive, where senior analyst Peter Kornbluh had been working for years to prod the government to release all classified documents on the Bay of Pigs. Kornbluh began demanding the full version of the Taylor Commission report in December, after determining that the document cleared for release by the CIA in 1996 had been lost by Pentagon officials. Skipping down, documents found in Soviet archives previously indicated that the Russians had learned some details of the operation in advance, but the Taylor Commission report shows for the first time that the CIA knew about the leak and proceeded with the invasion nevertheless. One wonders not only how the leak was determined. There certainly was no shortage of intelligence leaks about the Bay of Pigs, but there are a number of aspects of the Bay of Pigs that we've noted in conjunction with the Kennedy assassination. In the Guns of November Part 1, we noted former Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty's assertion, and he was involved in the chain of communication for the airstrike that was to neutralize Castro's Air Force. He contended that CIA officials, including Charles Cabell, had deliberately delayed the airstrike to neutralize Castro's Air Force, thus hoping to force Kennedy's hand by compromising the Bay of Pigs invasion and forcing the military to launch an all-out invasion of Cuba. The invasion plan called for the neutralization of Castro's air force. According to Prouty, the CIA officials on site deliberately sabotaged that plan, trying to force Kennedy's hand in an outright military assault on Cuba. I would also note that in the remarkable book Let Justice Be Done by William Davey, there is discussion of an operation in which some anti-Castro Cubans were going to be dressed in Cuban military uniforms and sent to attack the U.S. Marine base, U.S. Naval base at Guantanamo. There they were going to launch an attack on and inflict casualties on the Marines guarding the base. This was to be blamed on Fidel Castro and again to precipitate an all-out U.S. assault on Cuba. Obviously that would have sacrificed the lives of American service personnel in order to precipitate that chain of events. So we will be talking about this more in the future. I would also note that there are elements of what I have termed the Underground Reich that were working with both the Soviets and the United States, and some of those were also quite sympathetic to Fidel Castro in Cuba. One of the people whose names has cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy in numerous contexts, as we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show entitled The Political Resume of George Bush, and an individual who has maintained very close contacts with the anti-Castro Cuban community through the intelligence community, those contacts running right up through the Iran-Contra scandal. That fellow, of course, was George Herbert Walker Bush, at one time Director of Central Intelligence, at another time Vice President, and later, of course, President of the United States. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from a recent biography of George W. Bush. It's called W. Revenge of the Bush Dynasty by Elizabeth Mitchell. This book was published by Hyperion Books and copyright the year 2000 by Hyperion Books. The excerpt here refers to where George Bush was and what he was doing on November 22nd, 1963. The excerpt reads, "On November 22nd, 1963, Barbara Bush was at the beauty parlor getting her hair done in Tyler, Texas, and writing a letter home. Back in September, George Bush had become the first declared Republican candidate for the 1964 Senate elections, a Goldwater Republican, and the two of them were now on a several-city campaign swing. George came to pick her up, and they flew on a Mr. Zeppo's private plane, which he disembarked in Fort Worth, and then flew the Bushes back to Dallas. They had to circle while they waited for the second presidential plane to take off." So George Bush on his way to Dallas on 11-22-63. More from this passage. "Later that day, George Bush called into the Federal Bureau of Investigation to report a rumor he had heard that James Parrott, who may have been a student at the University of Houston, had been talking of killing the president." Bush's name has been linked with the assassination of President Kennedy in a number of different contexts. He was a very good friend of George de Morenshield, the White Russian and apparent former Nazi spy, who was one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence handlers. George Bush's name has, of course, been at the very center of the Iran-Contra scandal. Not only was George Bush not out of the loop, but as we looked at in material from the book The Secret War Against the Jews by Mark Loftus, by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, George Bush's private intelligence agency, the interagency governmental networks put together as a result of the recommendations growing out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, were in fact the main vehicle for affecting the Iran-Contra scandal, as well as the Iraqgate affair that overlapped it. In the book, research credit on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience who researched that last item for us. This is from Iran-Contra, The Final Report by Lawrence E. Walsh, Independent Counsel. This edition is published by Times Book, a division of Random House Incorporated, and it reproduces Volume 1 of the Office of Independent Counsel document in its entirety. One of the remaining questions, some of the remaining questions that Lawrence Walsh, the Iran-Contra Special Counsel, had for George Bush involved the following. Reading from the Iran-Contra Final Report, "Independent counsel's continuing investigation exposed evidence that called into question previous statements made by Vice President Bush concerning his knowledge of and involvement in the Iran-Contra matter. The purpose of a second interview with Bush was to resolve inconsistencies. The second interview would have focused primarily on these areas," and then skipping down, "Bush's meeting with Israeli official Amiram Nir in July of 1986 particularly focusing on Secord's recollection that after Bush's report of this meeting, Reagan authorized the resumption of the Iran arms sales. So please note that one of the questions that Lawrence Walsh had for George Bush involved a meeting with that Bush had with Israeli Israeli official Amiram Nir in July of 1986, focusing on Richard Secord's recollection that after Bush's report of this meeting, Reagan authorized the resumption of the Iran arms sales. Now note the following detail. This research for us by the same listener. This comes from the book Gideon Spies, The Secret History of the Mossad. That was authored by Gordon Thomas. It was published by Thomas Dunn Books. This is a subsidiary of St. Martin's Press. This book was published in March, copyright 1989. And there's discussion in here of that particular meeting at the King David Hotel in Tel Aviv. This involved the meeting between Amiram Nir and George Bush. Please note that there is speculation here that Amiram Nir, who died in a plane crash, may very well have been killed in order to avoid the resulting embarrassment to George Bush. This Amiram Nir was killed in a private plane crash in Mexico. Please note that a couple of other people who died in a plane crash in a relative not too long after that were also allegedly at this meeting. Reading now from Gideon Spies by Gordon Thomas, we find, increasingly, Mossad believed that the CIA had murdered Nir. According to Ari Ben-Menashe, quote, Israeli intelligence has always believed it was a well-executed CIA operation. Nir's death ensured that there would be no embarrassment for Reagan and Bush at the trial of Oliver North, unquote. Support for this theory came from a U.S. Navy commander who had accompanied Nir to Tehran on the fruiterer's mission to free the Beirut hostages. The commander's story revolved around his claim that Nir had met with George Bush, then vice president, on July 29, 1986 at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem to brief him about the ongoing sale of U.S. arms via Israel to Iran. According to the writer Joel Bainerman, quote, Nir was secretly taping the entire conversation. And this provided him with evidence linking Bush to the arms for hostages deal. At the meeting were McKee and Gannon, who would die in the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie. The allegation being here that Charles McKee and Mr. Gannon, members of the McKee team, military intelligence operatives who had been in Lebanon to locate the U.S. hostages, and who, according to the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report, the Aviv report, had learned of the connection between the Iran-Contra operators and Manzer El-Kassar, a Syrian arms dealer who was at the very center of the Iranian arms deals and who also secured East Bloc arms for the Contras, and who, according to the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report, was deeply involved in the bombing of Pan Am 103, McKee and Gannon and the McKee team were on their way back to the United States to blow the whistle about Manzer El-Kassar and his involvement with the Iran-Contra team when Pan Am 103 went down. And Manzer El-Kassar's name has been linked to that bombing in a number of different contexts. The insurance investigators report blamed it on him. Other investigative reports have linked his name to the bombing in other ways. Manzer El-Kassar, again a Syrian arms dealer, effected some of his Iran-Contra arms sales through various corporate fronts that were involved with some of the what I call the underground Reich, including the Merex firm founded by Otto Skorzeny and Gerhard Mertens, one of Skorzeny's wartime associates. So note here, according to the book Gideon's Spies, this particular meeting with Amiram Nir, who died later in a plane crash in Mexico, and also McKee and Gannon, who died in Pan Am, Flight 103, were these were people present at this particular meeting. Nir was certainly present, according to Ben-Menashe. He had taped, or actually, according to writer Joel Bainerman, he had taped this conversation. McKee and Gannon were present at that particular meeting. Note that George Bush's involvement in that particular meeting was one of the focal points of Lawrence Walsh's investigation into the Iran-Contra affair. Couple of other articles relevant to things we've been dealing with in the past. The New York Times of Saturday, April 29th of the year 2000 has an article which is sort of a 20-year follow-up to Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd of 1980. This will come as no shock to veteran listeners, but it is interesting. An article by Joseph Kahn, Dateline Washington, April 28th, headlined, "A Fund is Planned by U.S. Companies for Nazi Victims." It reads in part, "A group of American companies that had factories in Nazi Germany plans to establish a fund that would aid people who suffered persecution under Hitler's rule, a gesture that comes as more American multinational corporations acknowledge having benefited from forced and slave labor during World War II. Well, in fact, 70% of the capital that flowed into Germany in the 1930s came from the United States. Another fascinating article about the future, the Financial Times of London of Friday, April 28th of the year 2000, an article by Vincent Boland in New York and John Labate or Labate in, Vincent Boland in London and John Labate in New York. UK and Germany eye NASDAQ deal. We'll see if this comes through. The London Stock Exchange and Deutsche Börse are considering a global alliance with NASDAQ, the U.S. technology stock market, if their plan to create a unified Anglo-German equity market succeeds. One wonders who really did win World War II. Again, reference Uncle Sam and the Swastika and other programs for information about U.S. corporate involvement with the Third Reich. It remains to be seen exactly who actually did win World War II. A chilling follow-up to For the Record program number 150 about the Columbine High School massacre. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, April 20th of the year 2000, article by Meredith May of the Chronicle, "Alameda Jolted by Hit Lists at High Schools." This article reads in part, "Hit lists posted at an Alameda high school threatening the murder of 105 students on today's anniversary of the Columbine High killings were composed on the family computers of three students arrested in connection with the threat." And skipping down, "Investigators found a trail of hate-filled email and websites showing that the two arrested boys and girl took 10 days to compose their lists, which were found posted on exterior walls at the school. Police also found tape, spray paint, and material for making signs in the teenagers' bedrooms. While school officials insisted Tuesday's episode was a hoax intended to shut down the school a few days before a spring break, police were more cautious and said more arrests may be coming." Skipping down, "Alameda is not the only city with Columbine jitters," and a number of other high schools have received similar types of, quote, hoaxes, unquote. Skipping down, "In the Alameda case, three hit lists were discovered on the Encinal campus early Tuesday by a custodian, one with names of seniors, another with names of juniors, and a third with names of sophomores. The senior hit list read, 'Dead seniors, the top 10 will effing die, will die on 4/20/2000. Somebody who was doing far more than just posting things on the web was a fellow named Baumhaumers. This was a lawyer who, as we found, Richard Baumhaumers, excuse me, from the Associated Press, Dateline McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, from the Chronicle of Saturday, April 29th of the year 2000. This is headlined, "Five Die in Pennsylvania Shooting Spree." This fellow, by the way, Richard Baumhaumers, was an immigration lawyer. "A white man opened fire in two suburban Pittsburgh shopping centers yesterday, killing five people and critically wounding a sixth in a racially motivated shooting spree," police said. The man was taken into custody. And skipping down, "The gunman fatally shot a person of Indian descent at an Indian grocery store, two employees at a Chinese restaurant, and a black man at a martial arts school. A Jewish woman who lived next door to the suspect's parents was found dead in her home. The gunman also fired shots at two synagogues, but no one was injured," police said. A swastika and the word Jew had been sprayed at one synagogue, police said. The suspect, Richard Baumhaumers, smirked at onlookers as he was led into a magistrate's office in Beaver Falls last night wearing a bulletproof vest. So more lone nuts at work here in the United States. That concludes this program. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.